chilled a little, and went to sleep. I stuffed her belongings into my pockets and went over behind the totem pole thing. The camera was there all right, set inside it, but there was no plate holder in the camera. I looked around on the floor, thinking he might have got it out before he was shot. No plate holder. I took hold of his limp, chilling hand and rolled him a little. No plate holder. I didn't like this development. I went to a hall at the back of the room and investigated the house. There was a bathroom on the right and a locked door, a kitchen at the back. The kitchen window had been jimmied. The screen was gone and the place where the hook had pulled out showed on the sill. The back door was unlocked. I left it unlocked and looked into a bedroom on the left side of the hall. It was neat, fussy, womanish. The bed had a flounced cover. There was perfume on the triple mirrored dressing table, beside a handkerchief, some loose money, a man's brushes, a key holder. A man's clothes were in the closet and a man's slippers under the flounced edge of the bed cover. Mr. Geiger's room. I took the key holder back to the living room and went through the desk. There was a locked steel box in the deep drawer. I used one of the keys on it. There was nothing in it but a blue leather book with an index and a lot of writing in code, in the same slanting printing that had written to General Sternwood. I put the notebook in my pocket, wiped the steel box where I had touched it, locked the desk up, pocketed the keys, turned the gas logs off in the fireplace, wrapped myself in my coat and tried to rouse Miss Sternwood. It couldn't be done. I crammed her vagabond hat on her head and swathed her in her coat and carried her out to her car. I went back and put all the lights out and shut the front door, dug her keys out of her bag and started the Packard. We went off down the hill without lights. It was less than 10 minutes' drive to Alta Brea Crescent. Carmen spent them snoring and breathing ether in my face. I couldn't keep her head off my shoulder. It was all I could do to keep it out of my lap. 8. There was dim light behind narrow leaded panes in the side door of the Sternwood mansion. I stopped the Packard under the porte-cochere and emptied my pockets out on the seat. The girl snored in the corner, her hat tilted rakishly over her nose, her hands hanging limp in the folds of the raincoat. I got out and rang the bell. Steps came slowly, as if from a long, dreary distance. The door opened and the straight silvery butler looked out at me. The light from the hall made a halo of his hair. He said, "Good evening, sir," politely, and looked past me at the Packard. His eyes came back to look at my eyes. "Is Mrs. Regan in?"
"No, sir."
"The general is asleep, I hope?"
"Yes. The evening is his best time for sleeping."
"How about Mrs. Regan's maid?"
"Matilda? She's here, sir."
"Better get her down here. The job needs the woman's touch. Take a look in the car and you'll see why." He took a look in the car. He came back.
"I see," he said. "I'll get Matilda."
"Matilda will do right by her," I said.
"We all try to do right by her," he said.
"I guess you'll have had practice," I said. He let that one go. "Well, good night," I said. "I'm leaving it in your hands."
"Very good, sir. May I call you a cab?"
"Positively not," I said. "As a matter of fact, I'm not here. You're just seeing things." He smiled then. He gave me a duck of his head, and I turned and walked down the driveway and out of the gates. 10 blocks of that, winding down curved, rain-swept streets under the steady drip of trees, past lighted windows in big houses and ghostly, enormous grounds, vague clusters of eaves and gables and lighted windows high on the hillside, remote and inaccessible, like witch houses in a forest. I came out at a service station glaring with wasted light, where a bored attendant in a white cap and a dark blue windbreaker sat hunched on a stool inside the seamed glass, reading a paper. I started in, then kept going. I was as wet as I could get already, and on a night like that you can grow a beard waiting for a taxi. And taxi drivers remember. I made it back to Geiger's house in something over half an hour of nimble walking. There was nobody there, no car on the street except my own car in front of the next house. I looked as dismal as a lost dog. I dug my bottle of rye out of it and poured half of what was left down my throat and got inside to light a cigarette. I smoked half of it, threw it away, got out again, and went down to Geiger's. I unlocked the door and stepped into the still warm darkness and stood there, dripping quietly on the floor and listening to the rain. I groped to a lamp and lit it. The first thing I noticed was that a couple of strips of embroidered silk were gone from the wall. I hadn't counted them, but the spaces of brown plaster stood out naked and obvious. I went a little farther and put another lamp on. I looked at the totem pole. At its foot, beyond the margin of the Chinese rug, on the bare floor, another rug had been spread. It hadn't been there before. Geiger's body had. Geiger's body was gone. That froze me. I pulled my lips back against my teeth and leered at the glass eye in the totem pole. I went through the house again. Everything was exactly as it had been. Geiger wasn't in his flounced bed or under it or in his closet. He wasn't in the kitchen or the bathroom. That left the locked door on the right of the hall. One of Geiger's keys fitted the lock. The room inside was interesting, but Geiger wasn't in it. It was interesting because it was so different from Geiger's room. It was a hard, bare, masculine bedroom with a polished wood floor, a couple of small throw rugs in an Indian design, two straight chairs, a bureau in dark-grained wood with a man's toilet set and two black candles in foot-high brass candlesticks. The bed was narrow and looked hard and had a maroon batik cover. The room felt cold. I locked it up again, wiped the knob off with my handkerchief, and went back to the totem pole. I knelt down and squinted along the nap of the rug to the front door. I thought I could see two parallel grooves pointing that way, as though heels had dragged. Whoever had done it had meant business. Dead men are heavier than broken hearts. It wasn't the law. They would have been there still, just about getting warmed up with their pieces of string and chalk and their cameras and dusting powders and their nickel cigars. They would have been very much there. It wasn't the killer. He had left too fast. He must have seen the girl. He couldn't be sure she was too batty to see him. He would be on his way to distant places. I couldn't guess the answer, but it was all right with me if somebody wanted Geiger missing instead of just murdered. It gave me a chance to find out if I could tell it leaving Carmen Sternwood out. I locked up again, choked my car to life, and rode off home to a shower, dry clothes, and a late dinner. After that, I sat around in the apartment and drank too much hot toddy trying to crack the code in Geiger's blue indexed notebook. All I could be sure of was that it was a list of names and addresses, probably of the customers. There were over 400 of them. That made it a nice racket, not to mention any blackmail angles, and there were probably plenty of those. Any name on the list might be a prospect as the killer. I didn't envy the police their job when it was handed to them. I went to bed full of whiskey and frustration and dreamed about a man in a bloody Chinese coat who chased a naked girl with long jade earrings while I ran after them and tried to take a photograph with an empty camera. 9. The next morning was bright, clear and sunny. I woke up with a motorman's glove in my mouth, drank two cups of coffee, and went through the morning papers. I didn't find any reference to Mr. Arthur Gwynne Geiger in either of them. I was shaking the wrinkles out of my damp suit when the phone rang. It was Bernie Oles, the DA's chief investigator, who had given me the lead to General Sternwood. "Well, how's the boy?" he began. He sounded like a man who had slept well and didn't owe too much money. "I've got a hangover," I said. He laughed absently, and then his voice became a shade too casual, a cagey cop voice. "Seen General Sternwood yet?" "Uh-huh. Done anything for him?" "Too much rain," I answered, as if that was an answer. "They seem to be a family things happen to. A big Buick belonging to one of them is washing about in the surf off Lido Fish Pier." I held the telephone tight enough to crack it. I also held my breath. "Yeah," Ole said cheerfully. "A nice new Buick sedan all messed up with sand and seawater. Oh, I almost forgot. There's a guy inside it." I let my breath out so slowly that it hung on my lips. "Regan?" I asked. "Huh? Who?" "Oh, you mean the ex-legger the eldest girl picked up and went and married? I never saw him. What would he be doing down there?" "Quit stalling. What would anybody be doing down there?" "I don't know, pal. I'm dropping down to look-see. Want to go along?" "Yes." "Snap it up," he said. "I'll be in my hutch." Shaved, dressed, and lightly breakfasted, I was at the Hall of Justice in less than an hour. I rode up to the 7th floor and went along to the group of small offices used by the DA's men. Oles was no larger than the others, but he had it to himself. There was nothing on his desk but a blotter, a cheap pen set, his hat, and one of his feet. He was a medium-sized blondish man with stiff white eyebrows, calm eyes, and well-kept teeth. He looked like anybody you would pass on the street. I happened to know he had killed 9 men, 3 of them when he was covered, or somebody thought he was. He stood up and pocketed a flat tin of toy cigars called Entractes, jiggled the one in his mouth up and down, and looked at me carefully along his nose, with his head thrown back. "It's not Regan," he said. "I checked. Regan's a big guy, as tall as you and a shade heavier. This is a young kid." I didn't say anything. "What made Regan skip out?" Oles asked. "You interested in that?" "I don't think so," I said. "When a guy out of the liquor traffic marries into a rich family and then waves goodbye to a pretty dame and a couple million legitimate bucks, that's enough to make even me think. I guess you thought that was a secret."
"Uh-huh."
"Okay, keep button, kid. No hard feelings." He came around the desk, tapping his pockets and reaching for his hat. "I'm not looking for Regan," I said. He fixed the lock on his door, and we went down to the official parking lot and got into a small blue sedan. We drove out Sunset, using the siren once in a while to beat a signal. It was a crisp morning, with just enough snap in the air to make life seem simple and sweet, if you didn't have too much on your mind. I had. It was 30 miles to Lido on the coast highway, the first 10 of them through traffic. Oles made the run in 3/4 of an hour. At the end of that time, we skidded to a stop in front of a faded stucco arch, and I took my feet out of the floorboards, and we got out. A long pier railed with white 2x4s stretched seaward from the arch. A knot of people leaned out at the far end, and a motorcycle officer stood under the arch, keeping another group of people from going out on the pier. Cars were parked on both sides of the highway. The usual ghouls, of both sexes. Oles showed the motorcycle officer his badge, and we went out on the pier, into a loud fish smell which one night's hard rain hadn't even dented. "There she is, on the power barge," Oles said, pointing with one of his toy cigars. A low black barge with a wheelhouse like a tug's was crouched against the pilings at the end of the pier. Something that glistened in the morning sunlight was on its deck, with hoist chains still around it, a large black and chromium car. The arm of the hoist had been swung back into position and lowered to deck level. Men stood around the car. We went down slippery steps to the deck. Oles said hello to a deputy in green khaki and a man in plain clothes. The barge crew of 3 men leaned against the front of the wheelhouse and chewed tobacco. One of them was rubbing at his wet hair with a dirty bath towel. That would be the man who had gone down into the water to put the chains on. We looked the car over. The front bumper was bent, one headlight smashed, the other bent up, but with the glass still unbroken. The radiator shell had a big dent in it, and the paint and nickel were scratched up all over the car. The upholstery was sodden and black. None of the tires seemed to be damaged. The driver was still draped around the steering post with his head at an unnatural angle to his shoulders. He was a slim, dark-haired kid who had been good-looking not so long ago. Now his face was bluish-white, and his eyes were a faint dull gleam under the lowered lids, and his open mouth had sand in it. On the left side of his forehead there was a dull bruise that stood out against the whiteness of the skin. Oles backed away, made a noise in his throat, and put a match to his little cigar.
"What's his story?"
The uniformed man pointed up at the rubbernecks on the end of the pier. One of them was fingering a place where the white 2x4s had been broken through in a wide space. The splintering wood showed yellow and clean, like fresh-cut pine.
"Went through there. Must have hit pretty hard. The rain stopped early down here, around 9 p.m. The broken wood's dry inside. That puts it after the rain stopped. She fell in plenty of water, not to be banged up worse. Not more than half-tide, or she'd have drifted farther, and not more than half-tide going out, or she'd have crowded the piles. That makes it around 10 last night. Maybe 9:30, not earlier. She shows under the water when the boys come down to fish this morning, so we get the barge and hoist her out, and we find the dead guy."
The plainclothes man scuffed at the deck with the toe of his shoe. Oles looked sideways along his eyes at me and twitched his little cigar like a cigarette.
Drunk?
He asked of nobody in particular. The man who had been toweling his head went over to the rail and cleared his throat in a loud hawk that made everyone look at him.
Got some sand, he said and spat. Not as much as the boyfriend got, but some.
The uniformed man said, could have been drunk. Showing off all alone in the rain. Drunks'll do anything.
Drunk hell,
the plainclothes man said.
The hand throttle's set halfway down, and the guy's been sapped on the side of his head. Ask me, and I'll call it murder.
Oles looked at the man with the towel.
What do you think, buddy?
The man with the towel looked flattered. He grinned.
I say suicide, Mac. None of my business, but you ask me, I say suicide. First off, the guy plowed an awful straight furrow down that pier. You can read his tread marks all the way, nearly. That puts it after the rain, like the sheriff said. Then he hit the pier hard and clean, or he don't go through and land right side up. More likely turned over a couple of times, so he had plenty of speed and hit the rail square. That's more than half throttle. He could have done that with his hand falling, and he could have hurt his head falling, too.
Oles said,
You got eyes, buddy. Frisked him?
He asked the deputy. The deputy looked at me then, at the crew against the wheelhouse.
Okay, save that, Oles said.
A small man with glasses and a tired face and a black bag came down the steps from the pier. He picked out a fairly clean spot on the deck and put the bag down. Then he took his hat off and rubbed the back of his neck and stared out to sea, as if he didn't know where he was or what he had come for. Oles said,
There's your customer, Doc. Dived off the pier last night, around 9 to 10, that's all we know.
The small man looked in at the dead man morosely. He fingered the head, peered at the bruise on the temple, moved the head around with both hands, felt the man's ribs. He lifted a lax, dead hand and stared at the fingernails. He let it fall and watched it fall. He stepped back and opened his bag and took out a printed pad of DOA forms and began to write over a carbon.
Broken necks, the apparent cause of death, he said, writing. Which means there won't be much water in him. Which means he's due to start getting stiff pretty quick now he's out in the air. Better get him out of the car before he does. You won't like doing it after.
Oles nodded.
How long dead, Doc? I wouldn't know.
Oles looks at him sharply and took the little cigar out of his mouth and looked at that sharply.
Pleased to know you, Doc. A coroner's man that can't guess within 5 minutes has me beat.
The little man grinned sourly and put his pad in his bag and clipped his pencil back on his waistcoat.
If he ate dinner last night, I'll tell you, if I know what time he ate it, but not within 5 minutes. How would he get that bruise? Falling?
The little man looked at the bruise again.
I don't think so. That blow came from something covered, and it had already bled subcutaneously while he was alive.
Blackjack, huh?
Very likely.
The little M.E.'s man nodded, picked his bag off the deck, and went back up the steps to the pier. An ambulance was backing into position outside the stucco arch. Oles looked at me and said,
Let's go. Hardly worth the ride, was it?
We went back along the pier and got into Oles's sedan again. He wrestled it around on the highway and drove back towards town along a 3-lane highway washed clean by the rain, past low rolling hills of yellow-white sand terraced with pink moss. Seaward, a few gulls wheeled and swooped over something in the surf, and far out, a white yacht looked as if it was hanging in the sky. Oles cocked his chin at me and said,
Know him?
Sure. The Sternwood chauffeur, I saw him dusting that very car out there yesterday.
I don't want to crowd you, Marlowe. Just tell me. Did the job have anything to do with him?
No. I don't even know his name.
Owen Taylor. How do I know? Funny about that. About a year or so back, we had him in the cooler on a man-act rap. It seems he runs Sternwood's Hotcha daughter, the young one, off to Yuma. The sister ran after them and brought them back and had Owen heaved into the icebox. Then next day she comes down to the DA and gets him to beg the kid off with the U.S. cuter. She says the kid meant to marry his sister and wanted to, only the sister can't see it. All she wanted was to kick a few high ones off the bar and have herself a party, so we let the kid go, and then darned if they don't have him come back to work. And a little later we get the routine report on his prints from Washington, and he's got a prior back in Indiana. Attempted holdup 6 years ago. He got off with a 6 months in the county jail, the very one Dillinger bust out of. We hand that to the Sternwoods, and they keep him on just the same. What do you think of that?
They seem to be a screwy family, I said. Do they know about last night?
No, I gotta go up against them now.
Leave the old man out of it if you can.
Why?
He has enough troubles and he's sick.
You mean Regan?
I scowled. I don't know anything about Regan, I told you. I'm not looking for Regan. Regan hasn't bothered anybody that I know of.
Ull said,
"Oh," and stared thoughtfully out to sea, and the sedan nearly went off the road. For the rest of the drive back to town, he hardly spoke. He dropped me off in Hollywood near the Chinese Theater and turned back west to Altabrea Crescent. I ate lunch at a counter and looked at an afternoon paper and couldn't find anything about Geiger in it. After lunch, I walked east on the boulevard to have another look at Geiger's store.
10. The lean, black-eyed credit jeweler was standing in his entrance in the same position as the afternoon before. He gave me the same knowing look as I turned in. The store looked just the same. The same lamp glowed on the small desk in the corner, and the same ash blonde in the same black, suede-like dress got up from behind it and came towards me with the same tentative smile on her face.
"Was it?"
she said, and stopped. Her silver nails twitched at her side. There was an overtone of strain in her smile. It wasn't a smile at all. It was a grimace. She just thought it was a smile.
"Back again," I said airily and waved a cigarette. "Mr. Geiger in today?"
I'm afraid not, no. I'm afraid not. Let me see. You wanted?"
I took my dark glasses off and tapped them delicately on the inside of my left wrist. If you can weigh 190 pounds and look like a fairy, I was doing my best.
"That was just a stall about those first editions," I whispered. "I have to be careful. I've got something he'll want. Something he's wanted for a long time."
The silver fingernails touched the blonde hair over one small jet-buttoned ear.
"Oh, a salesman,"
she said.
"Well, you might come in tomorrow. I think he'll be here tomorrow."
"Drop the veil," I said. "I'm in the business, too."
Her eyes narrowed until they were a faint greenish glitter, like a forest pool far back in the shadow of trees. Her fingers clawed at her palm. She stared at me and chopped off a breath.
"Is he sick? I could go up to the house," I said impatiently. "I haven't got forever."
Her throat jammed. I thought she was going to fall on her nose. Her whole body shivered and her face fell apart like a bride's pie crust. She put it together again slowly, as if lifting a great weight by sheer willpower. The smile came back with a couple of corners badly bent.
"No," she said. "No, he's out of town. That wouldn't be any use. Can't you come in tomorrow?"
I had my mouth open to say something when the partition door opened a foot. The tall, dark, handsome boy in the jerkin looked out, pale-faced and tight-lipped, saw me, shut the door quickly again, but not before I had seen on the floor behind him a lot of wooden boxes lined with newspapers and packed loosely with books. A man in very new overalls was fussing with them. Some of Geiger's stock was being moved out. When the door shut, I put my dark glasses on again and touched my hat.
"Tomorrow, then. I'd like to give you a card, but you know how it is."
"Yes, I know how it is."
She shivered a little more and made a faint sucking noise between her bright lips. I went out of the store and west on the boulevard to the corner and north on the street to the alley which ran behind the stores. A small black truck with wire sides and no lettering on it was backed up to Geiger's place. The man in the very new overalls was just heaving a box up on the tailboard. I went back to the boulevard and along the block next to Geiger's and found a taxi standing at a fire plug. A fresh-faced kid was reading a horror magazine behind the wheel. I leaned in and showed him a dollar. "Tail job?" He looked me over.
"Cop?"
"Private."
He grinned. "My meat, Jack."
He tucked the magazine over his rearview mirror and I got into the cab. We went around the block and pulled up across from Geiger's alley, beside another fire plug. There were about a dozen boxes on the truck when the man in overalls closed the screened doors and hooked the tailboard up and got in behind the wheel.
"Take him," I told my driver.
The man in overalls gunned his motor, shot a glance up and down the alley, and ran away fast in the other direction. He turned left out of the alley. We did the same.
I caught a glimpse of the truck turning east on Franklin and told my driver to close in a little. He didn't or couldn't do it. I saw the truck two blocks away when we got to Franklin. We had it in sight to Vine and across Vine and all the way to Western. We saw it twice after Western. There was a lot of traffic and the fresh-faced kid tailed from too far back. I was telling him about that without mincing words when the truck, now far ahead, turned north again. The street at which it turned was called Brittany Place. When we got to Brittany Place, the truck had vanished. The fresh-faced kid made comforting sounds at me through the panel, and we went up the hill at 4 miles an hour looking for the truck behind bushes. Two blocks up, Brittany Place swung to the east and met Randall Place, in a tongue of land on which there was a white apartment house with its front on Randall Place and its basement garage opening on Brittany. We were going past that, and the fresh-faced kid was telling me the truck couldn't be far away when I looked through the arched entrance of the garage and saw it back in the dimness with its rear doors open again. We went around to the front of the apartment house, and I got out. There was nobody in the lobby, no switchboard. A wooden desk was pushed back against the wall beside a panel of gilt mailboxes. I looked the names over. A man named Joseph Brody had apartment 405. A man named Joe Brody had received $5,000 from General Sternwood to stop playing with Carmen and find some other little girl to play with. It could be the same Joe Brody. I felt like giving odds on it. I went around an elbow of wall to the foot of tiled stairs and the shaft of the automatic elevator. The top of the elevator was level with the floor. There was a door beside the shaft lettered Garage. I opened it and went down narrow steps to the basement. The automatic elevator was propped open, and the man in new overalls was grunting hard as he stacked heavy boxes in it. I stood beside him and lit a cigarette and watched him. He didn't like my watching him. After a while, I said, "Watch the weight, bud. She's only tested for half a ton. Where's the stuff going?"
"Brody, 405, he said. "Manager?"
"Yeah. Looks like a nice lot of loot." He glared at me with pale, white-rimmed eyes.
"Bucks," he snarled. "100 pounds of box easy, and me with a 75-pound back."
"Well, watch the weight," I said. He got into the elevator with 6 boxes and shut the doors. I went back up the steps to the lobby and out to the street, and the cab took me downtown, again to my office building. I gave the fresh-faced kid too much money, and he gave me a dog-eared business card, which for once I didn't drop into the majolica jar of sand beside the elevator bank. I had a room and a half on the 7th floor at the back. The half-room was an office split in two to make reception rooms. Mine had my name on it, and nothing else, and that only on the reception room. I always left this unlocked, in case I had a client and the client cared to sit down and wait. I had a client. 11. She wore brownish, speckled tweeds, a mannish shirt and tie, hard-carved walking shoes. Her stockings were just as sheer as the day before, but she wasn't showing as much of her legs. Her black hair was glossy under a brown Robin Hood hat that might have cost $50 and looked as if you could have made it with one hand out of a desk blotter.
"Well, you do get up,"
she said, wrinkling her nose at the faded red settee, the two odd semi-easy chairs, the net curtains that needed laundering, and the boys-size library table with the venerable magazines on it to give the place a professional touch.
"I was beginning to think perhaps you worked in bed, like Marcel Proust."
"Who's he?" I put a cigarette in my mouth and stared at her. She looked a little pale and strained, but she looked like a girl who could function under a strain.
"A French writer, a connoisseur in degenerates. You wouldn't know him."
"Tut, tut," I said. "Come into my boudoir." She stood up and said,
"We didn't get along very well yesterday. Perhaps I was rude."
"We were both rude," I said. I unlocked the communicating door and held it for her. We went into the rest of my suite, which contained a rust-red carpet, not very young, 5 green filing cases, 3 of them full of California climate, an advertising calendar showing the Quinns rolling around on a sky-blue floor in pink dresses with seal-brown hair and sharp black eyes as large as mammoth prunes. There were 3 near-walnut chairs, the usual desk with the usual blotter, pen set, ashtray and telephone, and the usual squeaky swivel chair behind it.
"You don't put on much of a front,"
she said, sitting down at the customer's side of the desk. I went over to the mail slot and picked up 6 envelopes, 2 letters and 4 pieces of advertising matter. I hung my hat on the telephone and sat down. "Neither do the Pinkertons," I said. "You can't make much money at this trade, if you're honest. If you have a front, you're making money, or expect to."
"Oh, are you honest?"
she asked and opened her bag. She picked a cigarette out of a French enamel case, lit it with a pocket lighter, dropped case and lighter back into the bag, and left the bag open. Painfully.
"How did you ever get into this slimy kind of business, then?"
"How did you come to marry a bootlegger?"
"My God, let's not start quarreling again. I've been trying to get you on the phone all morning, here and at your apartment."
"About Owen?" Her face tightened sharply. Her voice was soft.
"Poor Owen,"
she said.
"So you know about that?"
"The DA's man took me down to Lido. He thought I might know something about it, but he knew much more than I did. He knew Owen wanted to marry your sister, once." She puffed silently at her cigarette and considered me with steady black eyes.
"Perhaps it wouldn't have been a bad idea,"
she said quietly.
"He was in love with her. We don't find much of that in our circle."
"He had a police record." She shrugged. She said negligently,
"He didn't know the right people. That's all a police record means in this rotten, crime-ridden country."
"I wouldn't go that far." She peeled her right glove off and bit her index finger at the first joint, looking at me with steady eyes.
"I didn't come to see you about Owen. Do you feel yet that you can tell me what my father wanted to see you about?"
"Not without his permission."
"Was it about Carmen?"
"I can't even say that." I finished filling a pipe and put a match to it. She watched the smoke for a moment. Then her hand went into her open bag and came out with a thick white envelope. She tossed it across the desk.
"You'd better look at it anyway,"
she said. I picked it up. The address was typewritten to Mrs. Vivian Regan, 3765 Alta Brea Crescent, West Hollywood. Delivery had been by messenger service, and the office stamp showed 8:35 a.m. as the time out. I opened the envelope and drew out the shiny 4¼ by 3¼ photo that was all there was inside. It was Carmen sitting in Geiger's high-backed teak wood chair on the dais, in her earrings and her birthday suit. Her eyes looked even a little crazier than as I remembered them. The back of the photo was blank. I put it back in the envelope. "How much do they want?" I asked.
$5,000, for the negative and the rest of the prints. The deal has to be closed tonight, or they give the stuff to some scandal sheet."
The demand came how?
"A woman telephoned me about 30 minutes after this thing was delivered."
"There's nothing in the scandal sheet angle. Juries convict without leaving the box on that stuff nowadays. What else is there?"
"Does there have to be something else?"
"Yes." She stared at me a little puzzled.
"There is. The woman said there was a police jam connected with it, and I'd better lay it on the line fast, or I'd be talking to my little sister through a wire screen."
"Better," I said. "What kind of jam?"
"I don't know."
"Where is Carmen now?"
"She's at home. She was sick last night. She's still in bed, I think."
"Did she go out last night?"
"No, I was out, but the servants say she wasn't. I was down at Las Olindas playing roulette at Eddie Mars's Cypress Club. I lost my shirt."
"So you like roulette?" "You would." She crossed her legs and lit another cigarette.
"Yes, I like roulette. All the Sternwoods like losing games, like roulette, and marrying men that walk out on them and riding steeplechases at 58 years old and being rolled on by a jumper and crippled for life. The Sternwoods have money. All it has bought them is a rain check."
"What was Owen doing last night with your car?"
"Nobody knows. He took it without permission. We always let him take the car on his night off, but last night wasn't his night off."
She made a wry mouth.
"Do you think?"
"He knew about this nude photograph?" "How would I be able to say? I don't rule him out." "Can you get $5,000 in cash right away?"
"Not unless I tell Dad, or borrow it. I could probably borrow it from Eddie Mars. He ought to be generous with me, heaven knows."
"Better try that. You may need it in a hurry." She leaned back and hung an arm over the back of the chair.
"How about telling the police?"
"It's a good idea, but you won't do it."
"Won't I?"
"No. You have to protect your father and your sister. You don't know what the police might turn up. It might be something they couldn't sit on. though they usually try in blackmail cases.
Can you do anything?
I think I can, but I can't tell you why or how.
I like you,
she said suddenly.
You believe in miracles. Would you have a drink in the office?
I unlocked my deep drawer and got out my office bottle and two pony glasses. I filled them and we drank. She snapped her bag shut and pushed her chair back.
I'll get the 5 grand,
she said.
I've been a good customer of Eddie Mars. There's another reason why he should be nice to me, which you may not know.
She gave me one of those smiles the lips have forgotten before they reach the eyes.
Eddie's blonde wife is the lady Rusty ran away with.
I didn't say anything. She stared tightly at me and added,
That doesn't interest you?
It ought to make it easier to find him, if I was looking for him. You don't think he's in this mess, do you? She pushed her empty glass at me.
Give me another drink. You're the hardest guy to get anything out of. You don't even move your ears.
I filled the little glass. You've got all you wanted out of me. A pretty good idea I'm not looking for your husband. She put the drink down very quickly. It made her gasp, or gave her an opportunity to gasp. She let a breath out slowly.
Rusty was no crook. If he had been, it wouldn't have been for Nichols. He carried $15,000 in bills. He called it his mad money. He had it when I married him, and he had it when he left me. Now, Rusty's not in on any cheap blackmail racket.
She reached for the envelope and stood up. I'll keep in touch with you, I said. If you want to leave me a message, the phone girl at my apartment house will take care of it. We walked over to the door. Tapping the white envelope against her knuckles, she said,
You still feel you can't tell me what Dad—
I'd have to see him first. She took the photo out and stood looking at it, just inside the door.
She has a beautiful little body, hasn't she?
Uh-huh. She leaned a little towards me.
You ought to see mine,
she said gravely. Can it be arranged? She laughed suddenly and sharply and went halfway through the door, then turned her head to say coolly,
You're as cold-blooded a beast as I ever met, Marlowe. Or can I call you Phil?
Sure.
You can call me Vivian.
Thanks, Mrs. Regan.
Oh, go to hell, Marlowe.
She went on out and didn't look back. I let the door shut and stood with my hand on it, staring at the hand. My face felt a little hot. I went back to the desk and put the whiskey away and rinsed out the two pony glasses and put them away. I took my hat off the phone and called the DA's office and asked for Bernie Oles. He was back in his cubbyhole. "Well, I let the old man alone," he said. "The butler said he or one of the girls would tell him. This Owen Taylor lived over the garage, and I went through his stuff. Parents at Dubuque, Iowa. I wired the chief of police there to find out what they want done. The Sternwood family will pay for it." "Suicide?" I asked. "No, can't tell. He didn't leave any notes. He had no leave to take the car. Everybody was home last night but Mrs. Regan. She was down at Las Olindas with a playboy named Larry Cobb. I checked on that. I know a lad on one of the tables." "You ought to stop some of that flash gambling," I said. "With the syndicate we got in this country? Be your age, Marlowe. That sap mark on the boy's head bothers me. Sure you can't help me on this?" I liked his putting it that way. It let me say no without actually lying. We said goodbye and I left the office, bought all 3 afternoon papers, and rode a taxi down to the Hall of Justice to get my car out of the lot. There was nothing in any of the papers about Geiger. I took another look at his blue notebook, but the code was just as stubborn as it had been the night before. 12. The trees on the upper side of Laverne Terrace had fresh green leaves after the rain. In the cool afternoon sunlight I could see the steep drop of the hill and the flight of steps down which the killer had run after his 3 shots in the darkness. 2 small houses fronted on the street below. They might or might not have heard the shots. There was no activity in front of Geiger's house or anywhere along the block. The box hedge looked green and peaceful and the shingles on the roof were still damp. I drove past slowly, gnawing at an idea. I hadn't looked in the garage the night before. Once Geiger's body slipped away, I hadn't really wanted to find it. It would force my hand. But dragging him to the garage, to his own car, and driving that off into one of the 100 odd lonely canyons around Los Angeles would be a good way to dispose of him for days or even for weeks. That supposed two things, a key to his car and two in the party. It would narrow the sector of search quite a lot, especially as I had had his personal keys in my pocket when it happened. I didn't get a chance to look at the garage. The doors were shut and padlocked, and something moved behind the hedge as I drew level. A woman in a green and white check coat and a small button of a hat on soft blonde hair stepped out of the maze and stood looking wild-eyed at my car, as if she hadn't heard it come up the hill. Then she turned swiftly and dodged back out of sight. It was Carmen Sternwood, of course. I went on up the street and parked and walked back. In the daylight, it seemed an exposed and dangerous thing to do. I went in through the hedge. She stood there straight and silent against the locked front door. One hand went slowly up to her teeth, and her teeth bit at her funny thumb. There were purple smears under her eyes, and her face was gnawed white by nerves. She half smiled at me. She said,
"Hello,"
in a thin, brittle voice.
"What? What?"
That tailed off, and she went back to the thumb. "Remember me?" I said. "Doghouse Riley, the man that grew too tall? Remember?" She nodded, and a quick, jerky smile played across her face. "Let's go in," I said. "I've got a key. Swell, huh?"
"Why? Why?"
I pushed her to one side and put the key in the door and opened it and pushed her in through it. I shut the door again and stood there, sniffing. The place was horrible by daylight. The Chinese junk on the walls, the rug, the fussy lamps, the teakwood stuff, the sticky riot of colors, the totem pole, the flagon of ether and laudanum, all this in the daytime had a stealthy nastiness, like a fag party. The girl and I stood looking at each other. She tried to keep a cute little smile on her face, but her face was too tired to be bothered. It kept going blank on her. The smile would wash off like water off sand, and her pale skin had a harsh granular texture under the stunned and stupid blankness of her eyes. A whitish tongue licked at the corners of her mouth. A pretty, spoiled, and not very bright little girl who had gone very, very wrong, and nobody was doing anything about it. To hell with the rich. They made me sick. I rolled a cigarette in my fingers and pushed some books out of the way and sat on the end of the black desk. I lit my cigarette, puffed a plume of smoke, and watched the thumb and tooth act for a while in silence. Carmen stood in front of me, like a bad girl in the principal's office. "What are you doing here?" I asked her finally. She picked at the cloth of her coat and didn't answer. "How much do you remember of last night?" She answered that, with a foxy glitter rising at the back of her eyes.
"Remember what? I was sick last night. I was home."
Her voice was a cautious, throaty sound that just reached my ears. "Like hell you were." Her eyes flicked up and down very swiftly. "Before you went home," I said, "before I took you home, here, in that chair," I pointed to it, "on that orange shawl. You remember all right." A slow flush crept up her throat. That was something. She could blush. A glint of white showed under the clogged gray irises. She chewed hard on her thumb.
"You were the one?"
she whispered. "Me. How much of it stays with you?" She said vaguely.
"Are you the police?"
"No, I'm a friend of your father's."
"You're not the police?"
"No." She let out a thin sigh.
What do you want?"
"Who killed him?" Her shoulders jerked, but nothing more moved in her face.
"Who else knows?"
"About Geiger? I don't know. Not the police, or they'd be camping here. Maybe Joe Brody." It was a stab in the dark, but it got her.
"Joe Brody! Him!"
Then we were both silent. I dragged at my cigarette, and she ate her thumb. "Don't get clever, for God's sake," I urged her. "This is a spot for a little old-fashioned simplicity. Did Brody kill him?"
"Kill who?"
"Oh, Christ," I said. She looked hurt. Her chin came down an inch.
"Yes,"
she said solemnly.
"Joe did it."
"Why?"
"I don't know."
She shook her head, persuading herself that she didn't know. "Seen much of him lately?" Her hands went down and made small white knots.
Just once or twice. I hate him.
Then you know where he lives?
Yes.
And you don't like him anymore?
I hate him.
Then you'd like him for the spot. A little blank again. I was going too fast for her. It was hard not to. Are you willing to tell the police it was Joe Brody? I probed. Sudden panic flamed all over her face. If I can kill the nude photo angle, of course, I added soothingly. She giggled. That gave me a nasty feeling. If she had screeched or wept or even nosedived to the floor in a dead faint, that would have been all right. She just giggled. It was suddenly a lot of fun. She had had her photo taken as ISIS, and somebody had swiped it, and somebody had bumped Geiger off in front of her, and she was drunker than a Legion convention, and it was suddenly a lot of nice, clean fun. So she giggled. Very cute. The giggles got louder and ran around the corners of the room like rats behind the wainscoting. She started to go hysterical. I slid off the desk and stepped up close to her and gave her a smack on the side of the face. Just like last night, I said. We're a scream together. Riley and Sternwood, two stooges in search of a comedian. The giggles stopped dead, but she didn't mind the slap any more than last night. Probably all her boyfriends got around to slapping her sooner or later. I could understand how they might. I sat down on the end of the black desk again.
Your name isn't Riley, she said seriously. It's Philip Marlowe. You're a private detective. Viv told me. She showed me your card.
She smoothed the cheek I had slapped. She smiled at me, as if I was nice to be with. Well, you do remember, I said. And you came back to look for that photo, and you couldn't get into the house, didn't you? Her chin ducked down and up. She was working the smile. I was having the eye put on me. I was being brought into camp. I was going to yell yippee in a minute and ask her to go to Yuma. The photo's gone, I said. I looked last night, before I took you home. Probably Brody took it with him. You're not kidding me about Brody? She shook her head earnestly. It's a pushover, I said. You don't have to give it another thought. Don't tell a soul you were here, last night or today, not even Vivian. Just forget you were here. Leave it to Riley.
Your name isn't...
She began and then stopped and shook her head vigorously in agreement with what I had said or with what she had just thought of. Her eyes became narrow and almost black and as shallow as enamel on a cafeteria tray. She had had an idea.
I have to go home now,
she said, as if we had been having a cup of tea. Sure. I didn't move. She gave me another cute glance and went on towards the front door. She had her hand on the knob when we both heard a car coming. She looked at me with questions in her eyes. I shrugged. The car stopped, right in front of the house. Terror twisted her face. There were steps, and the bell rang. Carmen stared back at me over her shoulder, her hand clutching the doorknob, almost drooling with fear. The bell kept on ringing. Then the ringing stopped. A key tickled at the door, and Carmen jumped away from it and stood frozen. The door swung open. A man stepped through it briskly and stopped dead, staring at us quietly, with complete composure.
13. He was a gray man, all gray, except for his polished black shoes and two scarlet diamonds in his gray satin tie that looked like the diamonds on roulette layouts. His shirt was gray, and his double-breasted suit of soft, beautifully cut flannel. Seeing Carmen, he took a gray hat off, and his hair underneath it was gray, and as fine as if it had been sifted through gauze. His thick gray eyebrows had that indefinably sporty look. He had a long chin, a nose with a hook to it, thoughtful gray eyes that had a slanted look, because the fold of skin over his upper lid came down over the corner of the lid itself. He stood there politely, one hand touching the door at his back, the other holding the gray hat and flapping it gently against his thigh. He looked hard, not the hardness of the tough guy, more like the hardness of a well-weathered horseman. But he was no horseman. He was Eddie Mars. He pushed the door shut behind him and put that hand in the lap-seamed pocket of his coat and left the thumb outside to glisten in the rather dim light of the room. He smiled at Carmen. He had a nice, easy smile. She licked her lips and stared at him. The fear went out of her face. She smiled back.
"Excuse the casual entrance," he said. "The bell didn't seem to rouse anybody. Is Mr. Geiger around?"
I said, "No. We don't know just where he is. We found the door a little open. We stepped inside." He nodded and touched his long chin with the brim of his hat.
"You're friends of his, of course?"
"Just business acquaintances. We dropped by for a book."
"A book, eh?"
He said that quickly and brightly, and I thought a little slyly, as if he knew all about Geiger's books. Then he looked at Carmen again and shrugged. I moved towards the door. "We'll trot along now," I said. I took hold of her arm. She was staring at Eddie Mars. She liked him.
"Any message? If Geiger comes back?"
Eddie Mars asked gently.
"We won't bother you."
"That's too bad,"
he said, with too much meaning. His gray eyes twinkled and then hardened as I went past him to open the door. He added in a casual tone,
"The girl can dust. I'd like to talk to you a little, soldier."
I let go of her arm. I gave him a blank stare.
"Kidder, eh?"
he said nicely.
"Don't waste it. I've got two boys outside in a car that always do just what I want them to."
Carmen made a sound at my side and bolted through the door. Her steps faded rapidly downhill. I hadn't seen her car, so she must have left it down below. I started to say, "What the hell?"
"Oh, skip it," Eddie Mars sighed. "There's something wrong around here. I'm going to find out what it is. If you want to pick lead out of your belly, get in my way."
"Well, well," I said. "A tough guy."
"Only when necessary, soldier."
He wasn't looking at me anymore. He was walking around the room, frowning, not paying any attention to me. I looked out above the broken pane of the front window. The top of a car showed over the hedge. Its motor idled. Eddie Mars found the purple flagon and the two gold-veined glasses on the desk. He sniffed at one of the glasses, then at the flagon. A disgusted smile wrinkled his lips.
"The lousy pimp,"
he said tonelessly. He looked at a couple of books, grunted, went on around the desk and stood in front of the little totem pole with the camera eye. He studied it, dropped his glance to the floor in front of it. He moved the small rug with his foot, then bent swiftly, his body tense. He went down on the floor with one gray knee. The desk hid him from me, partly. There was a sharp exclamation and he came up again. His arm flashed under his coat and a black Luger appeared in his hand. He held it in long brown fingers, not pointing it at me, not pointing it at anything.
"Blood," he said. "Blood on the floor there, under the rug. Quite a lot of blood."
"Is that so?" I said, looking interested. He slid into the chair behind the desk and hooked the mulberry-colored phone towards him and shifted the Luger to his left hand. He frowned sharply at the telephone, bringing his thick gray eyebrows close together and making a hard crease in the weathered skin at the top of his hooked nose.
"I think we'll have some law," he said.
I went over and kicked at the rug that lay where Geiger had lain. "It's old blood," I said. "Dried blood."
"Just the same, we'll have some law."
"Why not?" I said. His eyes went narrow. The veneer had flaked off him, leaving a well-dressed hard boy with a Luger. He didn't like my agreeing with him.
"Just who the hell are you, soldier?"
"Marlowe is the name. I'm a sleuth."
"Never heard of you. Who's the girl?"
"Client. Geiger was trying to throw a loop on her with some blackmail. We came to talk it over. He wasn't here. The door being open, we walked in to wait. Or did I tell you that?"
"Convenient," he said. "The door being open. When you didn't have a key."
"Yes." "How come you had a key?"
"Is that any of your business, soldier?"
"I could make it my business." He smiled tightly and pushed his hat back on his gray hair.
"And I could make your business my business."
"You wouldn't like it. The pay's too small."
"All right, Bright Eyes. I own this house. Geiger is my tenant. Now, what do you think of that?"
"You know such lovely people."
"I take them as they come. They come all kinds."
He glanced down at the Luger, shrugged, and tucked it back under his arm.
"Got any good ideas, soldier?"
"Lots of them. Somebody gunned Geiger. Somebody got gunned by Geiger who ran away, or it was two other fellows, or Geiger was running a cult and made blood sacrifices in front of that totem pole, or he had a chicken for dinner and liked to kill his chickens in the front parlor." The gray man scowled at me. "I give up," I said. "Better call your friends downtown."
"I don't get it," he said. I don't get your game here.
Go ahead, call the buttons. You'll get a big reaction from it.
He thought that over without moving. His lips went back against his teeth.
I don't get that either, he said tightly.
Maybe it just isn't your day. I know you, Mr. Mars, the Cypress Club at Las Olindas. Flash gambling for flash people. The local law in your pocket and a well-greased line into L.A. In other words, protection. Geiger was in a racket that needed that, too. Perhaps you spared him a little now and then, seeing he's your tenant. His mouth became a hard, white grimace.
Geiger was in what racket?
The smut book racket. He stared at me for a long, level minute.
Somebody got to him, he said softly. You know something about it. He didn't show at the store today. They don't know where he is. He didn't answer the phone here. I came up to see about it. I find blood on the floor, under a rug, and you and a girl here.
A little weak, I said, but maybe you can sell the story to a willing buyer. You missed a little something, though. Somebody moved his books out of the store today. The nice books he rented out.
He snapped his fingers sharply and said, I should have thought of that, soldier. You seem to get around. How do you figure it?
I think Geiger was rubbed. I think that is his blood, and the books being moved out gives a motive for hiding the body for a while. Somebody is taking over the racket and wants a little time to organize.
They can't get away with it, Eddie Mars said grimly.
Who says so? You and a couple of gunmen in your car outside? This is a big town now, Eddie. Some very tough people have checked in here lately, the penalty of growth.
You talk too damned much, Eddie Mars said.
He bared his teeth and whistled twice, sharply. A car door slammed outside and running steps came through the hedge. Mars flicked the Luger out again and pointed it at my chest.
Open the door.
The knob rattled and a voice called out. I didn't move. The muzzle of the Luger looked like the mouth of the Second Street Tunnel, but I didn't move. Not being bulletproof is an idea I had had to get used to.
Open it yourself, Eddie. Who the hell are you to give me orders? Be nice and I might help you out.
He came to his feet rigidly and moved around the end of the desk and over to the door. He opened it without taking his eyes off me. Two men tumbled into the room, reaching busily under their arms. One was an obvious pug, a good-looking pale-faced boy with a bad nose and one ear like a club steak. The other man was slim, blonde, deadpan, with close-set eyes and no color in them. Eddie Mars said,
"See if this bird is wearing any iron."
The blonde flicked a short-barreled gun out and stood pointing it at me. The pug sidled over flat-footed and felt my pockets with care. I turned around for him like a bored beauty modeling an evening gown.
"Now gun," he said in a burry voice.
"Find out who he is."
The pug slipped a hand into my breast pocket and drew out my wallet. He flipped it open and studied the contents.
"Name's Philip Marlowe, Eddie. Lives at the Hobart Arms on Franklin. Private license, deputy's badge and all. A Seamus."
He slipped the wallet back in my pocket, slapped my face lightly, and turned away.
"Beat it,"
Eddie Mars said. The two gunmen went out again and closed the door. It was the sound of them getting back into the car. They started its motor and kept it idling once more.
"All right, talk,"
Eddie Mars said. The peaks of his eyebrows made sharp angles against his forehead. "I'm not ready to give out. Killing Geiger to grab his racket would be a dumb trick, and I'm not sure it happened that way, assuming he has been killed. But I'm sure that whoever got the books knows what's what, and I'm sure that the blonde lady down at his store is scared batty about something or other, and I have a guess who got the books."
"Who?"
"That's the part I'm not ready to give out. I've got a client, you know." He wrinkled his nose.
"That,"
he chopped it off quickly. "I expected you would know the girl," I said.
"Who got the books, soldier?"
"Not ready to talk, Eddie. Why should I?" He put the Luger down on the desk and slapped it with his open palm.
"This," he said, "and I might make it worth your while."
"That's the spirit. Leave the gun out of it. I can always hear the sound of money. How much are you clinking at me?"
"For doing what?"
"What did you want done?"
He slammed the desk hard.
"Listen, soldier, I ask you a question and you ask me another. We're not getting anywhere. I want to know where Geiger is, for my own personal reasons. I didn't like his racket and I didn't protect him. I happen to own this house. I'm not so crazy about that right now. I can believe that whatever you know about all this is under glass, or there would be a flock of Johns squeaking sole leather around this dump. You haven't got anything to sell. My guess is you need a little protection yourself. So cough up.
It was a good guess, but I wasn't going to let him know it. I lit a cigarette and blew the match out and